Okay, so this is Bio 160. We're done with spring break. And welcome back, everybody. We have a quiz scheduled for next time. And on the syllabus, it says that it's going to be the cardiovascular system and immunity. And since we are not covering immunity today, I can't put that on the quiz, right? I certainly don't want to put that on the quiz, even though you could study for it in the back of the your study guide and probably do pretty good. But I think I'm going to postpone that part of the quiz. So the quiz is only going to cover cardiovascular system and not immunity. And then maybe we'll just drop immunity from the quiz sequence, or maybe I'll put it on the next one. I'm not really sure. All right, so that's next time. And the other thing, today's class, unfortunately, has got to be a short class because I got to go talk to Margie Lewis. Who's Margie Lewis? Anybody know Margie Lewis? Well, she's actually the president of the college. She's the president of the college, and I got a meeting with her at 2 o'clock. So I got to excuse myself early, but maybe you could stick around and just review the questions in that student study guide and prepare for the quiz. Okay? So, I got to go talk to my boss at 2. The big boss, that's right, the big boss. But as far as I know, I'm not in trouble, so that's okay. All right, so let's see. We were talking a bunch about the heart last time, and I think we talked about all the structures inside the heart. Should we see if this goes? Right on. And there was a study guide and all that kind of stuff. So the really good exam figure that you should know everything on, in at least this particular chapter, of course, is this one right here, right? So make sure you know all the various chambers. How many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does the heart have? Four, yeah, just four and four, okay? And then you got to know some of these vessels right over here in the septum between the ventricles and these papillary muscles. All right, so as far as valves go, you have two different kinds. This is just a review from last time. You have so the chambers are atria, right? An atrium and an atrium here, a right atrium and a left atrium, and ventricles, a right ventricle and left ventricle. There's a valve between them, so we call that an atrioventricular valve. And you got two of those, one here and one here. So you got two atrioventricular valves. And then you got to know this is the tricuspid and this is the bicuspid. Just always remember, what was a good way that you remember that one? Oh, you don't. Try before you buy. All right. Yeah, try before you buy. So as you're reading, right, from left to right, it's tricuspid and bicuspid over here. And then the other valves that you have are between a ventricle and a big artery. And this big artery is the aorta. And here is the semilunar valve. So this is you don't have semilunar on your sheet, all right, but it's a semilunar valve. And there's also a semilunar valve between the right ventricle and the pulmonary artery. There's a semilunar valve. So that's all four. Two atrioventricular, and associated with the atrioventricular valves are the chordae tendineae and these papillary muscles. And in the valve between the ventricle and an artery, it's not a AV valve, but it's a semilunar valve, and it does not have chordae tendineae, and they're not attached to papillary muscles, but those valves are strong enough all by themselves to close during the heart cycle. All right, so this is a really good figure that you should appreciate. Okay, now does that heart pump blood all the time? Is it like an electric motor pumping blood all the time? Or does it pump and then relax? Pump and then relax. Yeah, okay. So, yes, it can't take a break through your whole life. It has to be pumping blood, but it can't do it continuously from second to second to second to second. All right, when the heart is contracting, that's when it pumps blood. And then when it relaxes, when it's relaxing, it can't pump blood. That's when blood actually returns to the heart and fills the heart up so that when it contracts again, it has something to pump out. So without that filling period, the heart can't pump any blood whatsoever. So I think we talked about that in terms of blood flow, right? There's systole and diastole. Systole is the contraction phase. That's when the heart is pumping. And then diastole right here is the phase of the heart cycle when the heart is actually relaxing. And both of those phases are real important to cardiac function, because it used to be that people were never interested in diastolic function because the heart wasn't pumping anything. But then people realized, well, you know what, during systole, the heart can't pump blood unless during diastole it fills up. So not only does the heart have to contract, it also has to do what? It's got to relax so that it can fill up with blood. So if it only contracts and it stays contracted, then you're going to be in heart failure as well. Okay? So it's got to relax so blood can get into it. So I think this is a review. When we talk about blood pressure, how many numbers do you get? You get two. Did we talk about that last time? Maybe. Okay. And you get those two numbers because one number is the peak pressure that your heart produces. That's during the contraction phase. We call that systolic pressure. And that's the first number. And then the second number is when your heart is relaxing, your blood pressure has a tendency to decrease until the heart pumps again. And so the lowest pressure is what we call diastolic pressure. And just with those two numbers, then we can characterize a normal or abnormal blood pressure in people pretty easily, just by those two numbers. And this is the normal number that you should have, 120 over 80. And as you get older, it has a tendency to go up a little bit, but you know what? It should never really be much over 120 over 80. Unless maybe you're in your 90s or 100 years old, it's going to have a tendency to go up, and there's not much we can do about that. But 120 over 80 is a good thing. What happens if your blood pressure is 130 over 80? What do we call that? High blood pressure. And then what's the fancy term for high blood pressure? We call it hypertension. Yeah, hypertension. And as a matter of fact, you can have hypertension if... So 120 is the systolic number, and 80 is the diastolic number. You can have hypertension if the systolic number is 120, but the diastolic number is 90. That's considered hypertension. So both of those numbers have to be at 120 over 80 or below. And if it's higher than that, then you should definitely consider changing your lifestyle or taking some kind of medication to lower your blood pressure, because that hypertension will kill various organs in your body. It can kill your kidneys and will kill your heart and retina and things like that. And the damage will build up day after day after day. So it's very important to treat hypertension. And so if you have any family members with hypertension, you have to be very supportive of them. Because here's the really strange thing about hypertension. When somebody has hypertension, when their blood pressure is high, say maybe 140 over 90 or something like that, that's when they feel great. That's when you feel really good, when you have hypertension, right? But you have to know that's killing your body. And when you take blood pressure medication to bring it down to 120 over 80 so that it's not hurting you, guess how you feel? That's when you have a tendency to feel really bad. So compliance, people have a tendency not to take their blood pressure medication because in a lot of circumstances it makes you feel bad. But that's the condition that's best for you to be in, because you're not killing parts of your body. And eventually, maybe over a period of a year or something like that, you'll adjust to that blood pressure, the normal blood pressure, and you'll start to feel fine again. But that whole period of a year, you might feel really lousy unless you just get the right kind of medication. So that's why if you know somebody with hypertension, you really have to be supportive for what? Maybe as long as a year, until they get the medication worked out. And a lot of times, with a lot of different kinds of treatment, you can't just take one drug. You got to take maybe a combination of drugs. And a physician will never know what combination works for you, because we're all different. So that's why sometimes it takes a while to get that all figured out. Maybe if you're a diabetic, you can't just take one medication. You have to take a couple. Or maybe if you have depression, you have to take a couple different kinds of medication. So it's rare, really, that one medication will be magic for you. Usually you have to work it out with a physician. But hypertension certainly is a killer, and you have to treat it seriously. Okay. All right, so that's just a review. All right, we talked about the conduction system. We talked about the ECG last time. And don't forget what depolarization. What is depolarization again? Depolarization is when sodium enters that cell. Okay, repolarization is when potassium leaves. And that depolarization is a signal for the heart to contract. But it's not the actual mechanical event. Before the heart contracts, it has to get the electrical signal. And as a matter of fact, if we could look at things in very fast motion, we could tell when we turn a switch, like a light switch on, as soon as we flip the switch, the light doesn't come on immediately. If we were to look fast enough, after we turn the switch, then the light would come on a little bit later. All right, so there's usually always a little delay between the electrical signal and when the actual event happens. Same thing for the heart. Okay, heart sounds. Who knows that your heart makes sounds? Yes, okay. And so there's two of them during the heart cycle. There's that lub and the dups, and sometimes we call it the first sound and second heart sound. And usually, as blood is rushing through the heart, it doesn't make much noise, which is a pretty good thing. But when those valves close, they make a sound because the valves actually slam closed because the pressures inside your heart and arteries are very high, and it's actually a really rough environment that the heart sits in and the blood is going through. So the valves actually get beat up pretty much every time the heart contracts. So let's see if we can figure out when these things close. Okay, so here is, and let's just consider one side of the heart. Here's the right side of the heart, here's the left side. They're going to behave the same. And let's consider the atrioventricular valve right over here. Okay, when does flow want to go from a ventricle into an atrium? Or how does flow go in general from one place to another? You know what? It goes the same way as diffusion. How does diffusion work again? It always goes from high concentration to low concentration. And any kind of fluid is always going to go from high pressure to low pressure. That's just the way that we've defined pressure and talk about it. So the normal flow of blood goes from an atrium into the ventricle and then out this artery. That's the normal flow. And that's the kind of blood flow that we want all the time. We don't want it to go backwards. If it goes backwards, it's going to kill the heart too. And these valves prevent that backward flow of blood. So blood will have a tendency to flow backwards, for instance, when the ventricles contract. That's pressurizing the ventricle. It's going to go higher than the pressure in the atria when the ventricles contract. And when it's higher in the ventricles than the atria, which way will blood want to go? So when it's high here and low here, blood is going to want to flow backwards across that valve. It's going to kill the heart. That's why there are valves right here. Those valves will close, right? So when the ventricle contracts, that's what we call the first heart sound. And when the ventricles contract, that forces closure of this atrioventricular valve, or AV valve. That's the first heart sound. So the lup is when the ventricles contract. But you got another sound, right? Okay, let's look and see if we can figure out what the next sound is. Okay, when the ventricles contract, like here it's contracting right here, it's trying to force blood back into the atria, but it can't because this tricuspid valve is closed. The pressure is high inside the ventricle, and it's low inside this artery, so blood is going to go from the ventricle into this artery right here. And you see this thing right here? That's an that is a semilunar valve. It's not an atrioventricular valve. It's a semilunar valve. It's a pulmonary semilunar valve. And so that's going to force blood into this pulmonary artery. Now, what happens to the pressure inside the ventricle when the ventricle relaxes? It's going to drop, right? It's going to drop very precipitously, maybe even go to zero, but there's still high pressure in this artery. And if it's high here and low here, which way is blood going to want to flow? Backwards. And as the blood flows backwards, the semilunar valve catches it and slams closed, and then blood can't flow backward into the heart, the wrong direction. And if it does, it's going to kill the heart. So when that semilunar valve closes, that's what we call the second heart sound. And that happens, what, after the first heart sound. And those are the two. So the first one is when the AV valve closes, when the ventricles contract. And the second heart sound is when the semilunar valve closes, when the ventricles do what? When they relax, when blood tries to flow backwards. And those are the two heart sounds. And they kind of sound like a lub and dup. Okay. Now every once in a while, somebody's going to have a problem with one of these valves, maybe a semilunar valve or an AV valve right here. It's not going to close completely. And blood might squirt back into the atrium, or blood might squirt from an artery back into a ventricle. And what do you think that little squirting sound sounds like? You've probably done this to irritate somebody. Sounds like air. Think of a, and I should have brought one in today, think of a balloon. Okay, you could blow a balloon up and you could let all the air flow out without restriction. But if you restrict the airflow through a balloon, what does it sound like? If you pinch it together, it goes what? Squeak, 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 right? You ever do that? No. Okay. Well, that's what these valves sound like then. And so instead of a nice lubbed up, you're going to hear a lub and then what? Squeak. Or you're going to hear a swishing sound or something. And when you hear those extra sounds inside the heart, that's what we call a heart murmur. And that's due to an insufficient valve that's not working correctly. And you get retrograde flow or backward flow of blood. So when you don't have a valve that's working correctly, that's going to kill the heart, and then it's got to be dealt with. You got to replace it or repair it or do something before the heart gets damaged. Right? So that's actually pretty easy to hear with a stethoscope is the instrument you can hear that with. Does anybody in here have a heart murmur? Should I bring in a stethoscope next time and we could all listen? I don't know if there's anybody with a heart murmur. Okay. Okay. Well, that's good. I'm glad. Because they can be pretty dangerous sometimes. Okay. So that's that one right there. Where's regulation of the heart? Oh, it's on this one. Oh, yeah, here we go. Regulation of the heart. How does the heart regulate itself, or how can you regulate a heart? Somebody was saying, you know, like in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom or something, or some Indiana Jones movie, it shows somebody ripping a heart out of somebody's chest and putting it on the table. And what does the heart do? It still beats by itself. And indeed, that's true. The heart will beat by itself, but other parts of your body, namely nerves and hormones, can adjust the rate at which it contracts. It can speed it up or slow it down, but the heart is going to beat all by itself no matter what, even if you take it out of the body, because it doesn't really need nerves. Okay? So what are the ways that the heart regulates itself? Well, there are two different ways. There's something called an intrinsic mechanism, and there's something called an extrinsic mechanism for regulating cardiac output. And the cardiac output is just the amount of blood that your heart pumps. And what the heck is cardiac output? Okay. Cardiac output is related to your heart rate. Right? So how fast your heart is beating sometimes can determine your cardiac output. But there's something else that's involved too. And that is the stroke volume. And what the heck is the stroke volume? The stroke volume is the amount of blood that's pumped out of your heart every time it beats. So if we look back at this figure over here, the stroke volume would be the volume of your heart when it's relaxed. That means it's big. And you subtract from that the amount of blood that's in this ventricle after it's done contracting. And the amount of blood that's different between when it's filled up and after it's done contracting is the amount of blood that's gone where? That's been pumped out. And that's what we call the stroke volume. Every time the heart beats, it pumps out a certain amount of blood. And you can measure that in milliliters or gallons or liters or whatever measurement you want. Right? But that's per beat, the amount of blood that your heart pumps every time it beats. That's not cardiac output. You have to multiply that by what? How many times your heart beats per minute. And that's called the heart rate. So heart rate times the stroke volume gives you your cardiac output, which is milliliters per minute. So it's a volume per minute. That's a flow. That's amount of blood flow per minute. All right, so your heart can regulate cardiac output by intrinsic and extrinsic mechanisms. I think we're going to look at an intrinsic mechanism first. Gosh, I don't know if I have it in the right order in your book. Okay, intrinsic regulation. This is what we call Starling's Law of the Heart. And it just says, okay, if we look at the force of contraction, or maybe myocardial contractility, you'll probably have to draw this in. I think I gave you some places to draw something, right? Because I think it will help you learn what's going on. Okay, versus myocardial stretch. That means how the muscle is stretching out. What happens to the, when you look at this diagram right here, what happens to the force of contraction as the heart gets stretched out? Does it increase or decrease or stay the same? Look, it increases. The force of contraction increases as the heart becomes stretched out, according to this graph right here. And when does the heart get stretched out? Like when you blow a balloon up, what happens to the balloon? It stretches, right? So as the heart is filling with blood, it has a tendency to get what? Stronger. It gets stronger as a result of that. Okay, so that's Starling's Law of the Heart. So that's pretty important. Now, how would you understand that to happen? How does that happen? Can you remember a sarcomere? What are the parts of a sarcomere? Woo. Did we talk about that yet? I think so. Like the actin and the myosin. And sarcomeres make up cardiac muscle, because cardiac muscle is striated. And so when you think of a sarcomere with actin and myosin, okay, let's just say these fingers are actin and these are myosin, what's the relationship between them? Are they like this or what? They're overlapped, right? And they slide past each other to make a muscle contract. Okay? So this just says, all right, that if the sarcomere is not stretched, that means that the actin and myosin, all right, is already butted up against each other. All right, if it's not stretched at all, so can this sarcomere contract anymore? Okay, I'm pushing the actin and myosin filaments to make them slide more and more and more, but can they slide? They can't slide, but if I stretch the muscle fiber, if I separate the actin and myosin a little bit, now what do they have the opportunity to do? They can now slide a little bit. They can slide past each other. So by stretching the heart muscle out, it gets stronger because of the overlap between actin and myosin. All right, so that's what this graph right here shows you. So cardiac filling, when the heart fills up with blood, if we increase cardiac filling, what's that going to do to stretch? What's going to happen to the actin and myosin? They're going to be forced to slide past each other a little bit. So that increases the stretch. And when the actin and myosin slide past each other, that increases the force of contraction. And as the heart gets stronger, can it pump more or less blood? More. The stroke volume becomes much more efficient. When the heart beats, it does it with more force. It ejects more blood. All right. And if you increase the stroke volume, what the heck happens to cardiac output? Okay? Yeah. Because if you increase stroke volume and keep the heart rate the same, cardiac output still has to go up, because it's just algebraic. It's just a really simple algebraic equation, right? Okay. So that's something interesting. All right. Now I got this other graph over here, the second graph. If we plot myocardial contractility versus stretch, and now let's stretch the muscle too much. This is kind of interesting. Okay, now, but think of that sarcomere. If we stretch the muscle too much, what's going to happen to the actin and myosin filaments? They won't be able to touch each other. They won't be able to form cross bridges. And if they can't form cross bridges, then what happens to that muscle? It gets very weak because they can't slide past each other. So this says that if the heart gets stretched too much, it's going to lose force. And if it doesn't get stretched enough, it's going to get weaker. So it has to be stretched, what? Just the right amount. And you have to know, as a health professor, health professional, how to manage each one of those particular conditions. Okay. So for instance, if somebody has a fluid overload in their body, and that could be due to too much dietary salt intake, that's going to produce hypertension, and that high blood pressure is going to fill the heart up with too much blood, and the heart muscle is going to get stretched and stretched and stretched and stretched. What happens to the heart's strength as more and more blood fills the heart up and then actin and myosin get pulled apart? The heart loses contractility and people can go into heart failure. We call that a dilated heart or a dilated cardiomyopathy. And when somebody is in heart failure, does anybody know what kind of drugs we like to give people that are in heart failure because of that? Adrenaline or epinephrine? Yeah, maybe at a moment's notice, but you could take these drugs. Actually, you should take these drugs every day by yourself. I wouldn't give adrenaline to somebody unless they're in a hospital and there's an ER. Baby aspirin would be good, but has anyone heard of giving diuretics? Okay, somebody's heard of giving diuretics, which is really good because a diuretic makes you pee, all right, and you lose volume from your blood, so you don't have so much blood going back to your heart. What happens to those actin and myosin now? They don't get so stretched out because you don't have so much blood going back to the heart. They have a tendency to what? Now overlap much better, and it moves the individual from a very weak heart in this condition right over here to what? A much stronger heart, because now you have a better overlap of the actin and myosin filaments, so the heart gets stronger. That's just an intrinsic property of the heart. All right. But now let's look at the other case. What happens for somebody, maybe they're going home from work or something, and they get into an accident, and they get really hurt in the accident, and they cut a big major blood vessel, and they start to lose a lot of blood. All right. Their blood pressure goes down, yet not enough blood gets back into the heart. And what happens to the heart then? The heart starts to shrink. It doesn't stretch so much. So now the actin and myosin don't have what? They can't slide past each other because they're already slid as far as they can go because their heart's not being stretched out. Now what do you do for somebody in that circumstance? Okay? On the way to the hospital, they hook up an IV, right? And they start putting fluids back into somebody to increase their blood volume, and what happens then to their heart? The actin and myosin start to slide past each other a little bit because now the heart is stretching. And what happens to contraction? It increases because now the actin and myosin have room to move, right? So the force of contraction increases. So depending on the particular pathology, sometimes for people you need to get rid of some blood volume by giving them a diuretic if they have too much fluid in their body, or if they're losing fluid, you have to replace it to get their heart strength back. So it's a particularly, I think, interesting mechanism to appreciate. Why do you want to give fluid sometimes? And why do you want to give a diuretic at other times to increase somebody's heart strength? It all depends on, it relates to what? The overlap of that actin and myosin, because the heart can't be strong if that actin and myosin can't slide past each other, because it's separated too far, or if they're slid past each other too much. Okay? So that's an intrinsic mechanism. We've got one more mechanism, and that's called the baroreceptor reflex. All right, right here. I got a picture of the baroreceptor reflex. Ah, here it is. All right, so a barometer, what does a barometer measure? Yeah, a barometer measures. You hear about it on the TV. You hear about it on the news report. Like the weather, the barometric, sounds like pressure, yeah. So the barometer measures pressure. So anytime you hear this baro, you just think of pressure, okay? And a barometer measures pressure. And you know what? We have pressure meters inside our body. There's two locations where there are autonomic sensors for blood pressure. And like right now, if you think about yourself someplace, you don't know what blood pressure you have, right? You don't see like a digital numbers in your visual field or anything like that. But your brain knows what your blood pressure is. It's just that you're not really, you don't know what that information is because you don't have a readout for it. Okay, and here are where the baroreceptors are. Okay, the baroreceptors are in the arch of the aorta, right here. So here's the heart, and here's the aorta. And that aorta is getting high-pressure blood from the left ventricle. There are also baroreceptors in the carotid arteries, this place called the carotid sinus, which is up in your neck. All right, that's up in your neck. And if your blood pressure is high, guess what happens to the size of these blood vessels? If your pressure is high, do you think the blood vessels dilate or do you think they constrict? Yeah, as you increase the pressure inside these vessels, the vessels have a tendency to stretch. And as it stretches, it stimulates these baroreceptors right here. So that's how your body measures pressure, just by stretch of these blood vessels. And that sense of stretch of the blood vessels gets sent to your medulla oblongata. I can't even remember if we've done nervous system yet. Have we done we've done nervous system. Yeah, so you know where your medulla oblongata is. All right? So that signals go to your medulla oblongata. And the medulla oblongata is smart enough to know if the pressure that is being measured by these baroreceptors is the correct pressure. If it's wrong, then the medulla is going to make a decision to correct it to bring it to where it should be. Increase it if it's too low or decrease it if it's too high. Because, for instance, right now you're sitting down, and if you were to stand up, your blood pressure is going to drop. And when your blood pressure drops as you stand up, you're going to have a tendency to faint or pass out. Okay? And we call that syncope. And those baroreceptors catch that decrease in blood pressure, sends a signal to your medulla, and the medulla is saying, oh, your blood pressure is dropping. You better do something so you don't faint or go into syncope. And your heart is going to speed up and maybe do some other things that I'm going to talk about. And it's going to bring your blood pressure back up to where it should be so you don't pass out. Okay? So that's what we call a nice homeostatic control mechanism involving these receptors right here in the aorta and the carotid and the medulla. All right, so how does that work? Let's just say, let's start the stimulus right here. Let's say that there is a drop in blood pressure. I think you have this slide. Okay. Or is it a previous slide? Let's see. Which one is that? Number 4. Number 5. Okay. Okay. Let's just start with an increase in blood pressure. What's going to happen to when blood pressure increases? What's going to happen to these baroreceptors here and here? Or what's going to happen to those blood vessels? They're going to stretch as the blood pressure goes higher, right? And they stretch and they send those signals to the medulla saying, oh, blood pressure is going way up. And when the baroreceptors get stimulated, the number of action potentials that go through these nerves to your central nervous system increases. Okay? And as blood pressure goes down, then the number of action potentials decreases. So high blood pressure stimulates the baroreceptors. And where does it go after the baroreceptors? To the medulla. Okay, so it's going to go to the medulla. The medulla is going to say, oh, blood pressure is too high. I need to do something about that. So it sends signals out through the parasympathetic nervous system to the heart. And the parasympathetic nervous system relies on a nerve called the vagus nerve. That's a cranial nerve. And maybe you had to know maybe a couple cranial nerves, and I think that was one of them. That's cranial nerve number 10. Okay. And the neurotransmitter that's used is acetylcholine. And And typically we just say acetylcholine is A-C-H, capital A, capital C, little h. So the parasympathetic nervous system is going to release this chemical on the heart. And that chemical on the heart is going to have an effect on the heart rate. And that's going to decrease the heart rate. And as the heart rate slows down, guess what happens to blood pressure? The blood pressure is going to decrease as well. Okay, blood pressure is going to go down. And this decrease in blood pressure, how does that affect the initial stimulus right here? Is it going to add to that initial stimulus or is it going to subtract from it? It's going to subtract because the initial stimulus was an increase, but the effect was a decrease. They're going to counteract each other, which is going to produce a normal blood pressure. So that kind of interaction we call negative feedback. All right, when the response subtracts from the stimulus, that's what we call negative feedback. And that's going to maintain your blood pressure. Okay. If your blood pressure goes the other way, if your blood pressure drops, like for instance you stand up, the baroreceptors, right? So if your blood pressure goes down, the baroreceptors are going to stop sending signals to the medulla. The medulla is going to say blood pressure is going down. Instead of sending signals to the parasympathetic nervous system, it's going to send signals to the sympathetic, because remember the sympathetic and parasympathetic are opposite in action, they're antagonistic to each other. The sympathetic nervous system is going to release a chemical called norepinephrine, and norepinephrine is going to increase the heart rate, and it's also going to increase the force of contraction. So epinephrine does a couple things. Let's go back to this slide. Epinephrine will increase heart rate, and it increases the stroke volume because the heart gets stronger. What happens to cardiac output? Yeah, it's got to go up, because if both stroke volume and heart rate goes up, cardiac output goes up. As a matter of fact, if either goes up, cardiac output is going to go up, but that's a very powerful effect because they both increase as a result of epinephrine. And you know what? I'm sure you all have experienced some sympathetic activity in your body. Like, have you ever been driving down the freeway and then all of a sudden an accident happens right in front of you, or somebody cuts you off and you see this thing happening right in front of you, and it looks like you have no escape? You're going to be involved in that accident. And what's happening to your heart then? Oh, it's pounding. It's going fast. So the heart rate is increased, the force of contraction, your heart is pounding inside your chest. And so that's a result of what? Sympathetic release of norepinephrine on the heart to increase your heart rate and stroke volume. And it takes a while actually to get over that. I was wondering why everybody's head was going more and more like that. Okay, so that's the baroreceptor reflex. And the important thing about the baroreceptor reflex is, do you think that it takes a long time to work, or is it rapid? It's rapid because it involves your nervous system, and nerves conduct these impulses very fast. Okay. So in terms of the baroreceptor reflex, right, that is no longer something that happens just inside your heart, right? It's something that involves what? It involves receptors that are outside the heart, that are on blood vessels. It relies on nerves. It relies on part of your brain, and then it relies on other nerves coming back to your heart. And since it relies on a lot of stuff that's not inside your heart, we don't call it intrinsic. We call it extrinsic regulation, because it needs a lot of other kinds of things besides things just inside the heart. But that Starling's law is not extrinsic. It's intrinsic because of what? Starling's law is just due to the overlap of the actin and myosin filaments. So we call that intrinsic regulation. Baroreceptor reflex is extrinsic regulation. Okay. All right, so the baroreceptor reflex is the most important kind of control mechanism for short-term regulation of blood pressure. So that's probably pretty important for you to write down. So not on a day-to-day basis or a weekly basis or whatever, but from a moment-to-moment control of your blood pressure, that's the baroreceptor reflex. So you should probably be aware of where the receptors are, okay, where the information goes to, namely your medulla, and then it goes back to the heart. Okay, so don't forget baroreceptors on the aorta and the carotid arteries. The cardioregulatory center, the thing that makes the decision on what to do with your heart, that's in the medulla. And then the medulla will make a decision to increase parasympathetic nervous system stimulation via the vagus or the sympathetic nervous system. And let's see, the parasympathetic nervous system is going to have, this is a good question for you, the parasympathetic, is it going to be stimulatory on the heart or inhibitory? The parasympathetic is inhibitory, and what about the sympathetic nervous system? It's going to be excitatory. It's going to be the opposite, because the parasympathetic and sympathetic are what? Antagonistic to each other in their whole design. And it's good to have both, right? Inhibitory and excitatory. And just think of your car. If you want to have precise control over your car, you need to have what? Both a brake pedal and an accelerator. One just won't do it. And control of your heart is so important that it needs this antagonistic mechanism for it to work properly. One to speed it up and one to slow it down. All right, well, you know what? I got to go. So don't forget, you have a quiz on the cardiovascular system next time.